Hello and welcome to another episode of the CCYSC Awaaz. CCYSC is the Critical Childhoods and Youth Studies Collective, an online network of scholars and practitioners researching children and childhood. And Awaaz is CCYSC's podcast series, which includes interviews and conversations with childhood researchers. My name is Ekta, and I'm a PhD student at Queen Mary, University of London. I'm in conversation today with Dr. Hedy Viterbo, who's a lecturer in law, also at Queen Mary. Today, we'll be talking about Dr. Hedy's new book titled Problematizing Law, Rights, and Childhood in Israel-Palestine. The book was recently published by Cambridge University Press. Welcome, Hedy. Hi.
Hi, Ekta.
Congratulations on the book.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be having this conversation with you.
It is such an engaging book, and as a reader, I felt completely immersed in the chapters and the concepts that are also deeply interwoven. And you also keep cross-referencing different chapters throughout your writing. And I think that this reflects the complexity of the issues at hand, the complex relationship between childhood, law, and state violence, especially in a space of conflict such as Israel-Palestine. But what you also do is, by giving numerous examples from the materials you examine, is to untangle this web to provide a clear picture of how exactly the legal system is being used and how the conceptualization of childhood and age are being orchestrated in Israel-Palestine. So to begin our conversation today, if I could ask you to provide a broad overview of what the book says, what the key arguments are, and who the protagonists are.
Yeah, sure. I think probably a useful way of doing that is through the book's title, because that gives us like an entry point into all of these themes and arguments. So the title is Problematizing Law, Rights, and Childhood in Israel-Palestine, right? Each of these words gives us a clue into what the book is about and what it does. And the book was written for readers that are interested in not necessarily all of these issues, but at least one of them. So for example, people who are very closely familiar with Israel-Palestine would hopefully learn a lot more about the local situation, but hopefully others who are not that familiar with it will also, but are just interested in reflecting critically about law, rights, or childhood, will also be able to gauge and obtain valuable insights, both locally, but also more general. And generalizable insights. So there are these three key themes: childhood, rights, and law. And maybe I should say a bit about each of them, because they seem self-explanatory, but hopefully whilst reading the book, it becomes evident that they're not as simple as they may appear. Yeah. So by childhood, the book deals with something that is much more than children. It's not just about a book about the young people that are usually defined as children. Mm-hmm. Childhood is something much broader. Mm-hmm. It's a way of thinking about the political reality. It's a way of shaping that reality and organizing it. It's a mode of control. It's a way of disciplining and governing not only these young people who are classified as children, but also adults. And also not just the adults that are related to children, such as parents or teachers, social workers, any adult, basically in one way or another is shaped and governed through this category, which is childhood. And one of the ways, one of the issues I analyze in the book is how adults are infantilized, how they're conceptualized and treated as children. For example, how violent soldiers are labeled as children and what that does. And we can speak about each of these things in greater detail later. Yeah. But basically what the book tries to do is show how childhood plays out in essentially every form of state violence. And that includes, for example, imprisonment, surveillance, travel restrictions, human shields, settler colonialism and the Jewish settlement project, food quotas, the severing of family ties, and so on and so on. So that's a bit about childhood. Now, rights, here I'm really interested in the role that human rights actors, both local and international, play. Human rights actors, but they're also legal actors in many respects, because they utilize the language of law, very broadly conceived. And I'm not talking just about how they operate within the formal legal system, but also how they take law as a device, as a discursive device, how they utilize and I'm also, and this is a central theme of the book that we can maybe expand on later, I'm also very interested in the book and how the state, in this case Israel, but it applies in different ways to other states, how the state is increasingly building on the language of rights and kind of co-opting and shaping and utilizing it for its own purposes. So that's about rights. And law, here I'm dealing a lot with the operation of legal institutions such as courts and the legislature. But for me, law is something, again, much broader than that. It's a discourse that can be utilized by everyone and is utilized by everyone and is shaped by everyone, even if they don't have formal legal training. So whenever the distinction really between legal and illegal is being used, what we have there is a site of law. So, so the book also tries to contextualize official law within the actions of lay people, the general public, the media, and these can be Palestinians, they can be Israelis, they can be international commentators. But law is a very flexible discourse, and each of these actors can really use and shape it in different and potentially competing ways. And that's one of the reasons why law, and this can also be said about rights, which is also, which are also very flexible. That's why both law and rights end up contributing and being complicit, heavily complicit, in state violence. And that's really a key theme of the book. So kind of trying to tie these all together, a main thread that cuts through many of the chapters is the legalism and as a result, the poverty of rights. By legalism, I mean the fact that a certain thing, in this case, human rights, are delineated or imagined only in legal terms. There's really a, almost a fetishism here of law, like a fixation of law. Mm-hmm. Everything is very narrowly legal. And that becomes a seemingly apolitical discourse, which is very problematic and potentially harmful in various ways. So that's maybe kind of a useful starting point for us.
Yeah, and in fact, I think the way you frame the idea of legal fetishism of law is something that I also observed in particularly chapters 2 and 3. Mm-hmm. And I would like to share a few facts with our audience here. So nowhere outside Israel-Palestine is an entire population's youth automatically and routinely prosecuted in military courts. And in fact, two of the legal mechanisms that you have also mentioned in your book are that of mass incarceration and the use of military courts. So again, sharing another fact that the average length of military court hearings for detention of Palestinians under 18 is only 3 minutes and 20 seconds. While most of the Palestinian youth speak Arabic, the military court proceedings are usually conducted in Hebrew. Or that the sentences of Palestinian youth are determined not based on their age when breaking the law, but instead on how old they are at the moment of sentencing. And the next one I find particularly interesting on how Israeli military law applies in Palestine imposes age categories that were inherited and modified from the British colonial law. However, inside Israel, these legal categories have long been abandoned. In this way, a colonial legacy continues in former colonies while not practiced in the land of the colonizer.
Mm-hmm.
And added to this then is how the NGOs, both local and international or UN organization, or even human rights scholars, what they have done to Palestinians and the harm that they have caused, which again you talk about in chapter 4 to discuss how human rights organizations have pushed Israel to separate Palestinian youth and adults in prisons. Mm-hmm. But as you explain later, is that such separation is actually very harmful for Palestinian youth. Could you explain a bit about what is the contribution of the human rights discourse on state violence in and beyond Palestine?
Yeah, thank you for these examples. I think there are various ways of answering your question. I think what the book tries to do in this context is kind of dispel perhaps several misconceptions that exist about human rights and law. And use the local case of Israel-Palestine to counter these myths. And you mentioned a few ways in which the human rights discourse and the human rights community end up implicated in state violence and contributing to it. But I just want to place that in contrast to some of the prevailing narratives about children globally and about the young people who are classified as children in Israel-Palestine. So these narratives, what we usually see, both in academic discourse and in public discourse, we're being told that children's rights are just being disregarded. International law is just being disregarded. But mm-hmm. what I show in the book is that actually Israel uses international law and child rights to perfect and legitimize its violence.
Yeah.
And I show that law and human rights in this context are not simply the solution to the problem, but part of the problem.
Hmm.
We often hear that Israel robs Palestinians of their childhood, but the book actually heavily criticizes this narrative about the loss of childhood. And what I argue is that actually Palestinians are being subjected to a legal childhood, to a legally enshrined childhood that actually works to their detriment. So you mentioned, for example, the fact, and this is something that I discuss in chapter 4, as you said, that human rights organizations push for harmful reforms. And you mentioned the reform of generational segregation, as I call it, mm-hmm. which is the increased separation of Palestinian children and adults in Israeli prisons. Maybe I should say a bit more about that, because I think it's not intuitive what that is and why it's harmful. And then I can say kind of what role international and local human rights organizations played in that regard.
Yeah.
So in the past, Israel used to try in courts and then in prison Palestinian children together, usually mostly together with adults. For the most part, there was very little, if any, separation based on age. Mm-hmm. And that, unsurprisingly, attracted a lot of criticism from all across the human rights community, because the perception was that this was a very serious violation of international legal and human rights norms, is enshrined, for example, in the Convention on the Rights of the Child and so forth. So for many years, human rights organizations really heavily criticized Israel and pushed for there to be a separation in courts, in detention, in prisons.
Hmm.
Eventually, the situation changed, and I describe this in detail in the book. And now what we have is, for the most part, this age separation. Israel established what it calls a military youth court. We can say maybe more about the military courts soon, but the military courts generally try thousands of Palestinians each year. So now this is the first country in the world to have a military youth court where hundreds of Palestinian children every year are tried. And we also have the separation in prison between, for the most part, between Palestinian youth and adults. So for the human rights eye and for children's rights advocates, this would seem as a huge victory, and it has been perceived as such for the most part. And I argue that it's actually harmful for both young Palestinians, older Palestinians, and I for various reasons that I discuss in the book, I'll just mention a few. I'll mention, for example, that Palestinian children are often report being abused by the Israeli authorities in prisons. So now that they're separated from the Palestinian adults, they're more exposed to this sort of abuse. We also know that from accounts of Palestinian children themselves, that while they were still held together with the adults before the separation, these adults actually provided them very valuable support that the Israeli authorities don't provide: psychological support, material care. They helped mitigate and mediate and resolve conflicts between children themselves. And in a sense, these adults were, according to testimonies of children, they were the closest substitute to parents, because these incarcerated children rarely get to see their parents for various reasons that I discuss in the book. And it was also harmful for the adults because in various ways it allowed Israel to more easily revoke the rights of these adults, who were now held separately and not given as much attention by the human rights community. And I also explain why the military youth court didn't make any actual difference to the way in which the Palestinian children are treated. There's no real difference. It's just a token reform, and one of many token reforms that Israel did, using the language of children's rights to present itself to the local and global community as a country that abides by the rule of law and by children's rights, and doing everything that it does to protect Palestinian children, supposedly. So this is just the background for understanding my arguments. Now, what I show through this case and through many, many other examples that go beyond prisons and have to do with various areas of life is how human rights organizations push for reforms or actions, or they themselves pursue legal actions that end up either harming Palestinian children or legitimizing punitiveness or apathy towards Palestinian adults. I can just mention another example that has to do with prison that comes to mind. In 2016, the Red Cross decided to reduce the family visits that it helps organize for incarcerated Palestinian men. It didn't change the visits that it arranges for children and women. So that, again, helps it helps in Israel in a sense, because for Israel, it's very convenient to depict Palestinian men, especially these are Muslim men. So this really speaks to a much global, broader global problematic trope that Muslim men are, by definition, by default, they're criminals, they're dangerous, they're terrorists. So what we end up with is that in various ways, the human rights community emulates, either strategically or unconsciously, emulates the Israeli security discourse and actually plays into the hands of Israel by pushing for various measures that end up operating as modes of state control and allow Israel to just make its control more sophisticated rather than dealing with the root causes of that violence. I could probably say a lot more about that, but I'll just I'll hand back the mic to you.
No, absolutely. So it is the use of law and the language of law that the Israeli authorities have used to sort of categorize children and young people as a security threat, and you know, therefore also justify the state violence. And what is interesting is that this framework of rights takes away not only from the young, but also from the adults, like you have just shared. So there is the one binary between adult and child that they have created, but there is also the other difference between Israeli childhood and Palestinian childhood. So for example, in chapter 7 and 8, you bring to light the various legal differences and tensions between how Israel approaches towards settler youths and towards Palestinian youth. And even for crimes which are very similar. So for example, for stone throwing, there's a different punishment for settler youth and different punishment for a Palestinian youth. And which, for example, Israel says that it is in the name of protecting its own children. So they justify the killing of Palestinian in the name of protecting their own children. And Israel also continues the practice of compulsory military service for both young men and women. And this value is deeply ingrained also in the Jewish school curriculum, to the extent that military service is considered a rite of passage to adulthood and full citizenship for Israeli youth. And I think one question that comes almost towards the end of the book, which I find extremely important, is, and I quote, whose safety, whose lives, and whose arguments are given most weight by Israel's courts? So I was wondering if you could talk a little about what the book reveals about the relationship between Israel and Palestinian childhoods, and what this could teach us more broadly about Israel-Palestine.
Thanks for that question. The book approaches that theme from various angles, one of which you alluded to in your question, which is really the institutionalized racial discrimination, or we could say legal apartheid, of which childhood is one but many arenas. And chapter 8, the last chapter, really, among other things, tries to shed new light and reveal new findings about this issue. For example, one thing I expose, and I think that can connect to what we were just talking about, I just mentioned how Israel decided to start separating Palestinian children from adults in prison, and how that was then justified as something that protects these children. One thing that I revealed through analysis of previously unpublished legal materials is that Israel actually pursued the opposite policy when Israeli settler youth were concerned. And one context that I discuss, and I'll just explain what I mean, is the context of the eviction of settlements from Gaza. Israel, some listeners may know that Israel unilaterally withdrew from the Gaza Strip in 2005, and since then has maintained violent control over the Gaza Strip, but has done that from the outside rather than by having constant boots on the ground. So while Israel evicted its settlements, many settlers came into conflict with the Israeli legal system. They protested against the unilateral withdrawal, and some of them were arrested, and some of their elders were also arrested, parents, just other adults. So what I showed is that in that context, and I show how this issue even came to parliament and was discussed there, it was actually decided that the best interest of settler youth requires that they be held together with adults from their communities. So in that case, rather than pursuing the norm, the legal norm of separating children from adults in prison, it was decided to go for the exception of holding them together. And this shows us about, it reveals kind of both the elasticity of legal norms and the inherently political nature of international legal norms, and the way in which they very easily lend themselves to competing uses in relation to the settler community versus the colonized community. The same norm can be applied in competing ways. Yeah. One community can have its incarcerated people segregated on the basis of age, mm-hmm. whereas and on the basis of law, supposedly, and the other can be kept together despite seemingly having a contrary legal norm. So that's one aspect of this relationship between Israeli and Palestinian childhoods. But I also go beyond just a fairly familiar theme of discrimination or apartheid, and I show how these two childhoods interact in less familiar ways. For example, one of the things I analyze is court cases of Israeli soldiers who were prosecuted for killing or abusing Palestinian children. Mm-hmm. And I should just say that that's actually quite rare, because as I explain in detail in the book, there's a culture of impunity in Israel, yeah. and armed forces very rarely are held to account for their violence. But there are a few exceptional cases which, as I also explain, very rarely lead to any convictions or actual heavy sentences. But still, these cases are very illuminating, because one of the things they show us is how, when you have a soldier in court and the victim is a Palestinian child, mm-hmm. what we actually end up with in the legal discourse, in the Israeli legal discourse, is two competing childhoods, because the Israeli soldiers are also portrayed by the courts and by the Israeli public as children. And then you have two competing childhoods, and there needs to be a moral and a legal balance, supposedly, between these two childhoods. And there's a question of what does that reveal to us about this category of childhood as a political and legal category, and what it lends itself to, and how elastic it is. So I could say more about Israeli childhood, but I think these two examples just show the richness of that issue.
Yeah. And yeah, and I think connected to this is also the idea of how age has been used as a tool of governance for Palestinian youth. So for example, in across four chapters, particularly chapters 3, 4, 6, and 7, you examine how Israel tries to discipline Palestinian adults through their younger counterparts. And you discuss how Israel portrays older Palestinians as weaponizing the youth and what forms of punishment and control this paves the way for. And in addition, in chapter 3, you discuss how in Israeli military trials, the young age of Palestinian youth has been considered to be an aggravating rather than a mitigating factor. And again, in chapter 6, you discuss Israel's rule of engagement, which claimed to prohibit shooting at young Palestinians. You show how, among other things, that these rules of engagement actually grant Israel's armed forces further impunity. And impunity has been sort of like a thread across the book. And of course, the restriction on movement, the food quota imposed on people living in Gaza. So I was wondering if you could elaborate on how childhood and age operate as tools of control and governing, and what broader lessons could we learn from this?
Yeah, gladly. I think in kind of exploring this theme, I was trying to break away with a certain tradition, both in legal and human rights discourses, where usually childhood is thought as a shield, as a protection. And there's just this assumption that children are a pre-existing group. They are, we have this self-evident distinction between children and adults, and children have their own natural characteristics. They need protection. All of that is taken for granted. And then all we have to do is make sure that international children's rights norms are being implemented. So there's a lot of preoccupation in academic and public discourse with non-implementation and what the applicable rights and law dictate and how they should be implemented. Hmm. I found that to be an extremely limited and uncritical discourse in for reasons that I explain. And what I and to answer your question, what I try to show, among other things, is that childhood actually does many other things and very different things, one of which is really operate as a control mechanism, as a governance mechanism. So one, maybe I think maybe I can illustrate this with examples, because otherwise it would sound very abstract.
Yeah.
One example that I mentioned on one context is travel restrictions. And I talk about the way in which age really lends itself for Israel as a risk management tool. Mm-hmm. How Israel micromanages the Palestinian population mm-hmm. by cutting it into age cohorts and then assigning to each age group risk level. And that dictates how much freedom of movement they have. And that obviously dictates also their access to their family, if they live afar, their access to health resources, their ability to travel to and get emergency health care, mm-hmm. their ability to even access their own lands, and so forth. So that's hugely important, all of these travel yeah. restrictions. And what we have there is that age really dictates who gets rights, who gets clearance, who gets certain entitlements. And in this context too, I should mention something that we touched on earlier, which is the complicity or the blindness of the human rights community. Here too, we have human rights organizations playing into this logic of age as a risk management tool. For example, 2 years ago, an Israeli NGO called Hamoked petitioned the Supreme Court asking that permanent residency permits be granted to Palestinians above the age of 55 years. So mm-hmm. permanent residency permits is something that is denied to many Palestinians residing in Israel. And rather than getting permanent permits to reside in Israel, they have to renew these permits frequently. And that basically keeps them in a state of uncertainty and certain limbo. And one of the themes I talk about in the book is how for Israel, uncertainty is also a mode of governance, because that allows a lot of ad hoc decisions and that keeps the power in the hands of agents and state agents on the ground. Yeah. So this petition by this Israeli NGO basically argued that older Palestinians above the age of 55 no longer pose a security risk, and therefore they should be allowed to stay permanently in Israel. So what that petition does is exactly what I was talking about earlier, adopt and emulate the Israeli logic, maybe strategically, but one of the things I show in the book is that this is a failed strategy. It doesn't actually lead to any achievements, but it does in various ways end up harming Palestinians. So here we see both the states and its critics use both childhood and age as a way to justify certain restrictions against certain populations. And so, so here it's about age. It's not just about childhood versus adulthood. It's about something related to that. Another example briefly is food quotas. I mentioned earlier that Israel withdrew its forces from Gaza in 2005. And now Israel imposes a prolonged closure on Gaza. And what that means, among other things, is that Israel heavily restricts the entry of food into Gaza, the entry of electricity, of water, export, import, the movement of people into and out of Gaza. So a very heavy closure. And during the first years of this closure, Israel also imposed on Gaza food quotas. So the military limited how many calories and how many grams of each food type each age group is entitled to consume per day. So this is really a micromanagement of the life of the local population through the logic of age, because they're divided into age group. And that, what I show in the book, is that was then justified by Israel by quoting international law, because Israeli lawyers argued that actually international law recognizes that in times of armed conflict, it's okay to draw these distinctions on the basis of age and gender. I link age and gender in various contexts in the book. So Israel said, okay, this just shows that international law recognizes such distinctions. Therefore, what we're doing here is actually both legal and humanitarian. So we see how age is used as a control mechanism and how in these contexts also, again, international law and the language of humanitarianism and human rights are used to maintain the self-image, at least, of Israel as a law-abiding democracy. Yeah, so I'll put a stop there.
Just listening to you, and it sort of brings back memory of reading the book and realizing how planned and strategically operationalized the occupation is. And when there is occupation, there is also resistance. And this is something of personal interest to me, that of childhood and political agency. And you talk about this throughout the book. So for example, in chapter 3, you discuss two practices of the Israeli state and the ways in which some Palestinians have tried to resist them. The first Israeli practice is travel restriction, like you also mentioned, which hinders Palestinians' access to healthcare and education, or even just visiting their family and friends. And as you demonstrate, these movement restrictions often draw distinctions between different age groups, as you also shared right now. And the second Israeli practice is that of sentencing and punishing Palestinian youth based on their perceived age rather than their chronological age. One of the interesting things you reveal is the Palestinian attempts to use their young appearance as a way to trick Israeli authorities. And if successful, Palestinians manage to enter Israel by appearing to be younger than they really are. By misrepresenting their chronological age, Palestinians are, in a sense, then also bending the boundaries of childhood. Can you share more about this? What does this teach us about childhood and political agency? And also, if you could talk about the phrases of, the chronological age and how age is performed by young Palestinians.
I think one of the things that emerges throughout the book is how elastic all of these things are, how elastic ages, how elastic childhood and law and rights are. So I think that also tries to complicate certain assumptions about the political reality, both in Israel, Palestine, but also anywhere else where we're dealing with law, rights, childhood and age. And really, as you were saying, one of the reasons for the plasticity or the fluidity of age and childhood is the fact that they're performative or they're based on various parameters, some of which are potentially competing, such as physical appearance versus chronological age. And that is something that plays out in very complex and sometimes incoherent ways in Israeli legal sites, such as courts and prisons, and I talk about that. But it also means, as you mentioned, that Palestinians can and have indeed harness that fluidity to their benefit, at least to a limited extent, because obviously there's a question here of power relations. But I think these limited instances are very of resistance are very important, because they reveal they reveal something really important about young people as political agents and about their ability to co-opt certain things that have been co-opted from them. I think just to add to what you're saying, a couple of other examples to illustrate that. So one, we were talking about prisons and how Israel has increasingly separated imprisoned Palestinians based on their age. And in that way, I argue in the book and in previous publications, has basically used age and children's rights as a divide and rule mechanism. But what the book also talks about is how Palestinians combat these attempts to break and fragment their society, both in and outside prisons, for example, by developing critical political consciousness, by trying to initiate political study groups in prisons, by, for example, smuggling sperm from prison, because one of the things that Israel prevents imprisoned Palestinians from doing, but it doesn't prevent Jewish prisoners from doing, is that they're not allowed to have conjugal visits. And that perhaps deliberately or not also operates as a way to control the Palestinian future, to prevent a certain generational continuity. So these are really interested in these and other examples mentioned in the book are interesting examples of how power meets resistance and how they shape each other and what broader lessons that teaches us kind of about the political nature of age and childhood and how they operate in sometimes surprising and unexpected ways.
And can you talk a little about how, because I found it interesting how young Palestinians sort of perform their age to trick the authorities and to, in the hope that their sentence will be lowered. If you can share a few examples.
Absolutely. By the way, one thing that the book shows, chapter 3 talks about how Palestinians do that, but chapter 8 also talks about how young Jewish settlers perform their age when they come in conflict with the Israeli legal system. The cases I analyze in relation to Palestinians are cases in which, as we mentioned earlier, Palestinians manage to trick the travel restrictions, and you were talking about that. And I examine cases where it's actually Palestinian adults, legally speaking, who presented themselves to the Israeli authorities as children. And because they were young, too young to be classified yet as a security risk, they were allowed into Israel. Now, eventually, when those individuals were later caught, they were obviously heavily penalized, not just for violating the travel restrictions, but also for lying about their age. Because if there's one thing that the law is really determined to do and is really preoccupied with, is being able to distinguish without any question marks between an adult and a child, because that distinction is the kind of the premise and the necessary condition for children's rights and child law. So now you have Palestinians both tricking the Israeli authorities by using their own age logic and using the performativity of age and kind of misrepresenting their age. But you also kind of, we also learn something here about law's anxiety about any violations of the boundaries of age and childhood. And in relation to Jewish settlers, what I discuss in chapter 8 is how when they are detained, having protested certain actions of the Israeli military, young Jewish settlers have repeatedly, when detained, have repeatedly refused to disclose their ages to the Israeli authorities. And that's really fascinating because that left the Israeli authorities unable to know what to do because they didn't even know in some cases whether these young people were below or above the age of criminal responsibility. So they didn't really know if they could be punished or not, or even held in detention. So children are really powerful political agents and very sophisticated sometimes. But also we see how adults, in the case of Palestinians, use childhood and apply that category to themselves, mm-hmm. wear it as a shield. So childhood really plays out, and age plays out in very different ways. They're very flexible and susceptible to different uses, both at the hands of the state, but also at the hands of the colonized and the settlers, who in different ways position themselves vis-a-vis the state.
Yeah. I'm also thinking about how, especially in childhood studies, and something that you have also mentioned in your book is how childhood is perceived at a global level. So for example, the binary between childhood and adulthood. And in your book, you refer to how the human rights organizations, when they are writing reports about children, they don't include their voices. They don't include children in the planning or even in the writing of their reports, because they assume that children are young and, you know, they can't distinguish between facts and fantasy. But you also maintain and argue throughout the book is that the need to contextualize Palestinian childhood in the lived reality of their experiences. Mm-hmm. And I find this interesting, that how are you able to sort of tread this tension, this anxiety between the local and the global? If you could talk about this a bit.
Yeah, sure. There are a few things there in your question, maybe both about kind of the voices of Palestinians and then the local versus the global. And I think one thing that ties both of these themes together is perhaps the tension between perceived global norms and then their application to local situations. And one of the limitations of children's rights and legal norms is that they rest on abstractions, certain assumptions about kind of children, about adults, just drawing very general norms that are then very easily applied without sensitivity to the context. So for example, just again to use the familiar issue we've covered of separating children from adults in prison, one of the fascinating things that I found is that actually imprisoned children themselves in their testimonies again and again describe how the imprisoned adult Palestinians were actually a huge source of support for them. Mm-hmm. So it's not an argument that I'm just coming up with. It's based on various testimonies of Palestinian youth. And what's fascinating here is that many of these testimonies appear in NGO reports. Mm-hmm. And yet the same NGO that cites this testimony completely ignores it and presents this issue as requiring separation. So it's very illogical. You have one report after the other arguing that children need to be separated without actually noticing. It's completely absurd, without noticing that the testimony that they quote also includes the child arguing against such separation. So we couldn't have a more blunt disregard for the local voices of Palestinian views, and these are for Palestinian youths, and these are the youths that these NGOs are claiming to serve. So it's as if kind of the local lived experience is just brushed aside in the name of perceived global international and human rights norms. And I also talk in this context about how human rights actors insist of depicting Palestinian youth as victims, yeah. As you mentioned, as unreliable witnesses, how they selectively edit their accounts, how they ignore power relations between themselves as adults and the young people whose testimonies they quote. So there's a lot of marginalization and misrepresentation and decontextualization here at work, and that's highly problematic. But I think what the book tries to do in this context and more broadly, not just in relation to the voices of Palestinian youth, is provide both new insights about the local situation, about the Israeli control regime, but also global insights. And I try to repeatedly draw parallels and connections with issues that have to do with legal norms, with human rights, with young people, with colonized people, and so forth in other countries, or national global policies and laws. So the book tried to do both, to kind of reflect both on the local and the global, and see how these realities are formed through the constant interaction and interplay of the global and the local.
As we draw to a close now, I'm wondering, is there something that you would like to add, something that we haven't discussed so far?
First of all, I want to thank you for this interesting conversation. I would just say that this book is really part of an ongoing journey or exploration. For me, I've been thinking, and I continue to think critically about childhood, about law, and about human rights. So I would just invite our listeners and the readers to get in touch if they have any thoughts and kind of engage in this conversation. It would be really interesting for me to hear the thoughts of people who are dealing with related or similar issues in other contexts, in order for this conversation to continue to be had more broadly, and for us as a community to be able to learn from each other. So yeah, that's it. And I would just say again, thank you very much. I really enjoyed the talk.
Thank you. And I also hope that our listeners will read this very important book. And thank you so much, Hedi, for your time. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in.